The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Steiner, and welcome this hour. We have the pleasure today to talk with United States Attorney Rod Rosenstein. He is a U.S. Attorney for the District of Maryland, where he oversees federal criminal and civil litigation, serves on the Advisory Committee of U.S. Attorneys, which evaluates and recommends policies for the Department of Justice. He's Vice Chair of the Violent and Organized Crime Subcommittee. He serves on the Attorney General's Anti-Gang Coordinating Committee. He's a former Justice Department official before that, where he served in the Tax Division and put those evaders in jail. He, during the Clinton administration, he served as counsel to the Deputy Attorney General and Special Assistant to the Criminal Assistant Attorney General. He joins us here live in the studio. I'm Rod Rosenstein. Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And, of course, we have a lot of programs we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about issues facing U.S. attorneys. We're going to talk about that office in Baltimore. We're going to talk about anti-terrorism. We're going to talk about Project Exile and the prosecution of people for gun crimes. Join us here at 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com as we talk with Rod Rosenstein, the U.S. attorney. We hear a lot in the papers about prosecutions of violent crime in Baltimore, and most of the most successful prosecutions have come out of the U.S. attorney's office. We'll talk about that and more. Your thoughts, 410-319-8888. Let's start there. There's a real disconnect for some people around the question of prosecution for gun crimes in the city of Baltimore and in the state of Maryland. City of Baltimore specifically for a moment, though. I mean, your office, if I have it right, I'm not sure I have the numbers right, you'll correct them. Around 90 prosecutions and people put away for gun crimes. The city, I think, has over 1,000, if I'm correct, gun cases a year, but put a smaller percentage maybe in prison. So talk about the discrepancy between 90 or so, you'll tell me the exact number, versus 1,000 or so, and the difference in why it seems the U.S. Attorney's Office puts more people in jail for gun crimes than the city state's attorney's office.
Well, we're actually up to about 200 defendants per year.
See, I told you I was wrong.
Here in Baltimore City. But there are a lot of explanations for the reason why the conviction rate is higher and why the sentences are longer.
Right.
One of the reasons, obviously, is that we have a greater degree of discretion as to which cases we bring, where the state's attorney's office and the police need to be more reactive in terms of the crimes that they prosecute. We have the ability.
What does that mean, what you just said, that they have to be more reactive?
Well, the prosecutor first default, the default prosecutor for every crime is going to be the local prosecutor. The U.S. Attorney's Office gets involved when we, in coordination with our federal partners, usually ATF, FBI, or DEA, working with the police and the state's attorney, we determine that that case ought to be brought in for federal prosecution. So when we do that, first of all, we're evaluating the evidence to make sure that it's going to be sufficient to hold up in federal court. Secondly, we're able to bring those federal resources to bear to do further investigation, to have those ATF, FBI, or DEA agents work with the local police and develop additional evidence in order to put that case together and prepare it for federal court. So that's why I think we have a higher conviction rate. In terms of the sentences, we have the advantage in federal court of sentencing guidelines and mandatory minimum sentences, which they don't have in state court. And that's one of the reasons why I think this exile program has been so effective, because what we've done is we've worked with our state partners. We've identified the defendants who are repeat offenders, who are violent individuals, drug dealers in Baltimore City, who have not been held properly accountable for whatever reason by the state system. In some cases, they've been prosecuted and acquitted, maybe because witnesses have been intimidated or attacked, maybe for a whole variety of reasons. But we've determined that these are folks who are responsible for a large proportion of the violence in Baltimore City, and therefore that they warrant federal prosecution. And then we're able to bring these additional federal resources to bear and the significant federal penalties. And one of the advantages those penalties give us is that we have the ability to gain cooperation from co-conspirators, from people who have been involved in criminal activities with our targets. And that's one of the things I think that's been most significant about the program. As we've proceeded, gone forward and increased the number of cases we bring into the system, as we increasingly prosecute defendants with significant criminal histories, we find that they're able to cooperate and give us more information about other defendants. That is, they know about crimes by their co-conspirators they know about crimes by rival criminals. And so we've been able to build a base of intelligence and develop additional cooperating witnesses that really help us in moving forward to hold people accountable.
A couple things you said, I think, kind of parse out a little bit here. I think that there's been a lot of criticism of Pat Chesimee and for her prosecutorial style and for her office not putting enough people away who have committed violent crimes. And people love to trot your example out as the way it should be done. And there's been a lot of issues around that. They've involved race and, you know, all its complexity in terms of his analysis about why that's happening. And I think it's important to explore for a moment. I mean, when you say that the some of the federal courts that are mandatory minimum sentences, these are sentences, if you're convicted of a crime, a judge has to put you in prison for X amount of years, whatever that crime calls for. And there are some people who might philosophically argue that's a dangerous thing to be able to happen, because then a judge cannot take into account the any kind of circumstances that may mitigate why this person committed a crime or is involved in life of crime. And on the other hand, people argue, well, no, that's part of the problem in Baltimore City, is that they can do that and the most violent offenders get away. So let's take one at a time. Let's talk about that. I mean, as a difference in how you look at the question of justice in our courts.
Well, you packed a lot of issues in there. Let me just start with the issue.
I'm sorry.
of the any criticism of the state's attorney. I want to make clear I'm not part of it.
No, I'm not asking you to criticize.
I have the luxury, right, really, of not being involved in that political process.
Right.
And my job is to do what I can to help our local prosecutor. And so we view the state's attorney, Pat Chesimee, and the police commissioner, Fred Bielfeld, as our partners in this program. And, in fact, I think it's particularly significant that when we talk about the federal successes, these 200 or so defendants we've prosecuted in the past year, those are cases we prosecuted for the most part jointly with the local police and with the cooperation of the state's attorney's office. In some cases, they've even partnered with us in the prosecution and had assistant state's attorneys working with us. So in our view, those are joint successes. But the issue that you've raised, I think, is significant. The political determination of whether or not there should or shouldn't be mandatory minimum sentences, that's made by the Congress. What we're presented with is the reality. Here are the potential sentences. How are you going to use this tool? And so what we've done is we've tried to make sure we use it in a responsible way, in making sure that we're determining which cases to prosecute federally based upon which defendants deserve those sentences. And so we look at criminal histories, we look at prior convictions, we look at arrests, we look at intelligence the police have about somebody's criminal background. They may have been arrested multiple times on murder charges, for example, and never convicted, and we try to get behind that as to why that is. Were they wrongly arrested, or were they properly arrested, and was there some reason why that case didn't result in a successful prosecution? So it is a significant tool, and I guess in theory it's potentially subject to abuse. That's one of the reasons why we're cautious about how we use it. And so we want to make sure that we're using these mandatory minimums for the right defendants. Now, keep in mind, most of these mandatory minimums apply because the defendants have a number of prior criminal convictions. The most significant ones require two or three prior convictions for violent felonies. So these are people who've already been adjudicated as dangerous criminals in the state system, and they've gone back to committing similar crimes.
So let me take one other step and come back to kind of another issue with this. So one of the issues facing Baltimore City and many local jurisdictions when they attempt to prosecute a violent crime is witness intimidation, fear of a community to step up and say what they've seen. And if you live in poor neighborhoods and spend time in them, you understand why people are frightened to have to walk out their door, and the same guys that you are going to prosecute, that you're going to testify against, are allies of the guys you see on the corner. And we've seen cases where people have been murdered because they're about to testify in Baltimore. And so what the difference there is, there's a huge gap here between what I think the federal government can do and what city and state can do.
Well, one of the other things that we're able to do is to detain defendants pending trial. And I think that's particularly significant when you have a situation where victims are living in fear of what people are going to do to them if they cooperate, and witnesses are living in fear. And so what we try to do in these federal cases where we have a defendant who's known to be violent, who represents a potential threat to witnesses, we try to get them detained without bail pending trial. One of the problems I think that you experience in a place like Baltimore City is that when people do cooperate, when they do go to the police and tell them what they know, they see somebody get arrested. If he's back out on the street again the next day because he's been bailed out or because the charges have been dropped, then they're going to be fearful of law enforcement. So I think it's particularly important when we get somebody who's a dangerous offender, who does represent a threat, that we do everything that we can to keep them off the street so that they're not going to be in position to intimidate witnesses. Now, the other thing that we need to do is to make sure that we react swiftly and effectively whenever anybody is attacked or intimidated. When I became U.S. Attorney in 2005, the Stop Snitching DVD was becoming famous, infamous, really, nationally. It arose here in Baltimore. And one of the things that's been really rewarding for me over the past 3.5 years is to see a number of people who were involved in that DVD prosecuted. Ironically, not because they were on the DVD. We didn't go out and target them because they were on the DVD. They came to our attention independently because criminals were involved in producing the DVD, because it was really a cynical attempt by people who were drug dealers and were involved in violence to try to intimidate witnesses and prevent them from cooperating. And so, for example, just most recently, Akiba Matthews, who was one of the persons involved in producing that DVD, was arrested and prosecuted in federal court on drug charges and sentenced to 30 years in federal prison. What's interesting about Mr. Matthews' case is that after participating in the Stop Snitching DVD and trying to intimidate people and stop them from cooperating with law enforcement, he was actually turned in by a citizen who saw him dealing drugs, called police, who responded to the scene and found him in possession of drugs and a gun. So I found that to be a particularly ironic and reassuring case, in that he didn't succeed in intimidating people. And the reality is, the majority of people don't want drug dealers, don't want violence in their community. And if we just provide them that assurance that if they do cooperate, we are going to send these people away and we're going to keep them safe, that is, the victims and witnesses, I think we can really turn things around.
Rod Rosenstein is our guest. He, since 2005, has been the United States Attorney. As we talked about a minute ago, has prosecuted over 200 gun-related cases in the state of Maryland, not just the city of Baltimore. 410-319-8888 is the number here. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. A lot of you have great many thoughts on our criminal justice system, on the rights of individuals and civil liberties, but also in getting the most violent criminals off the street. Your thoughts about that. And 410-319-8888 is the number here as we talk with Rod Rosenstein. When you talk about a prosecution like that, I mean, you just said someone said they saw him dealing drugs. He had a gun in possession. He had obviously what would probably not be a huge quantity of drugs on him if he was on the corner selling, or had him on the corner. So how does that turn into a federal case, and how does that turn into a 30-year sentence?
Well, he actually was arrested in possession of 58 gel caps of heroin and a loaded 40 caliber gun, so a substantial amount of drugs and a weapon. The way that turns into a federal case is really as a result of the exile program. What we've done is we put into place a program whereby whenever any significant criminal is arrested in Baltimore with a gun, and when I say significant, I mean either a drug dealer or somebody with a felony record, somebody who we know represents a potential danger. That case is screened for potential federal prosecution. What happens is, in the normal process, the police make the arrest, the case is referred to the state's attorney's office, and charges are filed in state court. At that point, the local police and prosecutors coordinate with ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and an assistant United States attorney in my office, review the case and determine whether or not the defendant warrants federal prosecution. And in making that decision, they look at things like the criminal history, the number of prior convictions the defendant has, the strength of the evidence, because we want to take these cases into federal court when we have a high degree of confidence of success. And we also look at the defendant's reputation on the street. When we say reputation, we're looking at intelligence. What do the police know about him? You know, often police have a pretty good idea of who's involved in drug dealing and fomenting violence in the neighborhood, even if they haven't been caught and arrested and prosecuted. So we gather all that intelligence and then make our decision about whether to bring the case federally. And one of the things that we consider is what the likely sentence is if that defendant is brought into federal court. In a case such as this one, if you're a felon in possession of a firearm, that increases your potential sentence. If you have a large quantity of heroin, that increases your potential sentence. And all those factors are considered in determining whether or not to bring the case into federal court.
Let me ask you a couple questions that may be a little difficult for you to answer, but let me ask you anyway. And again, we're talking about Rod Rosenstein, who is the United States Attorney for Maryland. 410-319-8888. A lot of the people that you prosecuted are prosecuted for drug-related issues, and obviously you're going after most violent offenders, not just drug dealers, but both. And a lot of people will argue in this country, as many have on my programs before, especially law enforcement officials from around the country, that the war on drugs has been a waste of time, that it hasn't done much to put a dent either in drug use or the trafficking of drugs in the United States of America, or the importation or manufacture of drugs in the United States of America. And that there must be better ways of doing this than wasting a prosecutor's time in putting people in jail for drugs.
Well, it's not just prosecutor's time. It's a tremendous amount of resources, taxpayer money, to prosecute the cases and then to incarcerate defendants. You're talking about $30,000 to $40,000 a year just to incarcerate somebody in federal prison. So
time to 30, 40, 50 years plus or life that people get usually from federal prosecutions.
It's a lot of money. Now, fortunately, I'm not in position. I don't make the laws. I enforce the laws.
But your thoughts? Can you speak to your thoughts on them, or is that something you cannot do?
No, I think I'm at liberty to speak to my thoughts, and then you can critique me if you feel appropriate. But I'll tell you my view about this. I was fortunate enough to become an adult without trying drugs. A lot of people did try drugs. Many people went on to live happy and productive lives, but many didn't. And when you see the people whose lives are ruined by drug addiction, that's really what it makes me think that it's worth fighting, because if drugs were legal, then I think that problem, the scale of that problem, would be much larger than it is today. And so if you want to look at this in a cost-benefit analysis, you'd want to weigh the cost of the war on drugs and any of the repercussions versus what kind of a society you think we'd have if drugs were legal. And for me, particularly as the parent of two small children, when I think about what they're going to confront growing up and what kind of lessons I want to teach them, I feel much more comfortable with a society where drugs are illegal. But I recognize that arguments can be made on both sides.
I mean, you can make the same argument, and probably it's much more detrimental because it is legal and because so many more people do it, is alcohol and what alcoholism does to people on the job. And I use this example a great deal of it. One of my oldest friends in life, who's clean now, but who spent, I don't remember what it was, 25 years or more as an expert in a major international corporation going to fix things that went wrong. And for those years, he was also a junkie. And it started to destroy his life, and he's drug-free now for 12 years. But that was a life he led. And so what I'm saying, but people do that with their martinis every day, as well as shooting heroin. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there are people who work in the federal government, in every office in Baltimore, and surgeons who are, alcoholics. So that's why, and I wonder if there's a better way for us to spend our federal money than going after the drugs, as opposed to going after violent criminals or other things that really disrupt our society. And what this really does, and I agree, none of us want our children to end up doing drugs or be in a society where that's appropriate.
It's interesting. I get the question just about every time I talk about
our
enforcement and violent crime enforcement program. And I recognize the argument. It's certainly an interesting political issue. But the reality that we're confronted with, of course, is that you have a drug culture that spawns tremendous violence and that ruins the lives of a lot of young children. You think about the kids who are growing up in the streets of Baltimore and in the schools of Baltimore facing these kind of challenges, drug dealers controlling their street corners, people being shot down in their neighborhoods, fearful of going out to the library or walking to school. And our job is to try to do everything that we can with the resources that we have to try to put a stop to that. And so that's really what motivates us on a daily basis.
Rod Rosenstein is our guest. These are your neighborhoods, our neighborhoods throughout the listening area here. We live in Prince George's County, Baltimore County, Baltimore City, wherever that is. 410-319-8888 is our number here. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on how we should handle drugs and violence in our community. We're here talking with Rod Rosenstein, who since 2005 has been the U.S. attorney, who has prosecuted some of the biggest drug gang cases in this in our state, put people away in federal prison. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Come to your calls in just a bit. The other issue that faces courts a lot, and I guess you may have a thought about this, you may not as well. I'm sure you have a thought on everything. You're a thoughtful guy. Is the commission just came out saying that Maryland should ban capital punishment. Clearly, it's going to be an issue that's going to be discussed and debated in the state legislature. That's not your purview, but it's going to be discussed in the state legislature. It's not a deterrent, and also for all lots of other reasons, some people argue it shouldn't exist. I'm curious, have you ever prosecuted somebody federally under capital punishment? Have they been executed? And your thoughts on the use of capital punishment in our criminal justice system?
We have. In fact, our office has prosecuted several death penalty cases over the past 10 years. And there are two defendants who were convicted and sentenced to death in cases prosecuted by my office, one in the late 90s, the other one in 2005, who are pending. Those cases take a long time before they're ultimately resolved. Nobody's been executed as a result of those cases, but they are pending. We also have a large inventory, though, of federal death penalty cases. And as the federal government...
Your office does?
My office does. As we increasingly get involved in violent crime, we come across more and more defendants who face potential death penalties. And in fact, in the 1990s, the Congress adopted a whole raft of new federal death penalty statutes so that any crimes involving drug dealing, for example, and many types of crimes involving guns are subject to federal death penalty. Carjacking, for example.
You mean when a murder takes place?
That's correct.
Right, right.
Or when somebody's killed as a result of drug dealing. And as a result, we have a large inventory of cases we're prosecuting where people could face the death penalty. And we have a protocol that we follow in the Department of Justice where in every one of those cases, the ultimate decision whether or not to seek the death penalty is made personally by the Attorney General. So it's a lengthy and detailed process that we're involved in. And we have, as a result of that, in addition to the cases we've had where death sentences have been imposed, there are a number of cases currently pending where defendants are facing potential death sentences. For example, we have a case involving an alleged witness retaliation murder of a fellow named John Dowry, who was murdered on Thanksgiving here in Baltimore City in 2006. In that case, two defendants are facing federal death penalty. They're scheduled for trial sometime in the next year. We have another case involving the murder of Carl Lackle, who was alleged to have been a witness in a murder here in Baltimore City. And a defendant in that case, Patrick Byers, is facing a potential death penalty.
Is that the guy who was working in an alley for a company and just saw a murder take place and thought it was his duty to report it? Is that the guy we're talking about?
I think that's the same guy.
He was shot when people opposed, saying, we want to buy your car, but they actually shot and killed him?
That's the allegation. That's
right,
correct.
Right.
So there are a number of cases currently pending. And as I said, we make a recommendation. That is, my office makes a recommendation, but the decision is made in those cases by the Attorney General. The reason for that is that the Justice Department, going back now to the Reno administration over 10 years, has tried to centralize that process so that we're applying a uniform standard nationwide, where states may have different policies as to the death penalty, but we have a uniform federal standard. So that's the way our process works internally.
We'll go to the phones here, Jared and Jane, our first two callers up. But when you talked about the cost of things, if you took all the moral and ethical issues out of capital punishment, set them aside for a minute, they're reams of them that you can argue for days that we've done on this show for 15 years now. But one of the practical arguments for some people argue against death penalty is the cost of it, the cost of appeals, the cost of people fighting for years and never being put to death because of the fights on death row, and B, all the DNA evidence and people who have, of course, been released from death row that we've seen all the stories now, and we've interviewed a number of those people who come off of death row. And so your thoughts on that aspect of it, and whether it makes more sense to just put somebody in jail for life, never to come out, never see the light of day, put them in a cell for 23 hours a day, isolate, let them pay for what they've done without putting them to death.
I think as a prosecutor, the thing that concerns me the most is to make certain that we're not prosecuting somebody and seeking the death penalty unless we're 100% confident that they're guilty. And so in those cases, we are particularly cautious. We're always cautious in the federal system, but we're particularly cautious in those cases to make sure we're confident before we bring the charges. And that involves not just the prosecutors and police officers or agents involved in the case, but we have a review by an independent team of prosecutors who scrutinize that evidence. In addition, in the federal system, we have extraordinarily capable defense attorneys who handle these cases. You're not going to have in any of our cases the sort of situations you sometimes see or allegations in state cases of defense attorneys who are incompetent or unprepared.
No, the U.S. Public Defender's Office.
Well,
what's it called?
The Federal Public Defender handles
public
some
defenders.
Of them. But many of them actually are handled by private defense attorneys as well, and they're all extraordinarily capable. And in addition to that, they have very large budgets. These cases can cost hundreds of thousands up to $1 million or more, so they're not constrained in the way some of the state defense attorneys are. As a result of that, my confidence in the guilt of the defendants that ultimately do receive the death penalty, because, of course, it's not just our review. You get a full trial and you get a jury of 12 people have to make a unanimous decision and a judge. And so as a result of that, I think that the procedural safeguards are in place in the cases that we prosecute. Now, the other issue that you raise is the cost. And again, that's the sort of political issue that it's not my responsibility to determine.
Right.
But I would say that one of the things we take into consideration that I think is relevant here is that we do consider the views of the victim's family in making our determination. The Attorney General takes that into consideration. So if you had a situation where the victim's family was strongly opposed to the death penalty or felt they didn't want to undergo the emotional strain of not only a death penalty trial, but then the appeals process. That would be considered in determining whether or not to go forward.
Rod Rosenstein is our guest, United States Attorney for the District of Maryland. He's been that job since 2005. His term ends up in 2009. He may well be here until 2009. Even though it's a Democratic administration, doesn't mean that Rod Rosenstein will be going anywhere. Am I correct about that?
That's correct.
All right. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Or you can write to us here at the Steiner Show at gmail.com. Let's go to the phones. Gerard in Catonsville, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome.
I wanted to comment on what the state attorney said about the gang culture
U.S. attorney.
And violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. attorney, I'm sorry. Saying that that was one of the main reasons why the war on drugs was a good idea. But I just wanted to suggest, as I've heard others suggest, that those kinds of things come out of the prohibition, just the way that the gang culture came out of the organized crime came out of prohibition of alcohol in the 20s. So it's you only have the kind of violent crime related to drugs because it's illegal. Where alcohol, now that it's legal, it can be regulated, it can be controlled. If you want to produce it on your own, you have to have a permit.
Excuse me.
And it's more rigidly controlled, whereas right now, with drugs being illegal, people have to go through all sorts of avenues to get what they want, and the people that are willing to give it to them are not always the nicest people.
You know, I take that point. I think that if you had heroin available at the CVS, then you wouldn't have drug dealers on the street corner battling over it. But as I say, I think you'd have other problems that that might well outweigh it. But my point was that that's a political decision. You know, as U.S. attorney, I'm stepping into a situation where I see an opportunity, or I saw an opportunity, where we could use our federal resources to try to reduce the level of violence and try to combat some of the drug dealing that really, I think, has caused great harm in Baltimore City. And that's why we've used those resources the way that we have.
Gerard, thanks so much for your call. I'm glad you were part of the show today.
Thank you.
410-319-8888 and Jane in Columbia, Maryland, you're on the air.
Yes, I had heard of a program. I'm not sure what country in Europe is doing it, but they have something in between, and it's not making it legal, but it's allowing it to be sold, or not sold so much as it's like you go to a place like a clinic and you get registered as a drug offender. I think the other fellow just mentioned something along that line, but I was wondering if anyone knows how is it working out. Does anyone know that?
You know, we were going to do a story about that last year. Things happened and we didn't get around to it. Maybe we can get around to it in our new home here. It was in Manchester, England, if I'm right, that they have a program that is doing just what you're suggesting, which is a clinical program. I've read an initial literature on it that says it's working. I don't know what it's working means. That's something we'd like to find out more about.
I understand there was a judge here, I think his name was Miller, but I'm not sure, who was on C-SPAN recently, and he said that he was told that they were had reduced the amount of crime by 65% by doing that program. And it sounded to me, and there was also an option in there that if at any time the drug addict wished to go to clean up his drug habit, he get that help.
Let me just, because we have to go to break here in just a minute, about a minute and a half, Rod can respond.
We do have treatment programs. We have a lot of treatment programs where we attempt to help addicts who are trying to get clean, trying to come off drugs. And there are even programs here in Baltimore City that will wean people off drugs by using legal drugs that are substitutes to some extent in an attempt to wean them off heroin, for example. But obviously the goal of those programs is to get people off drugs, not to maintain them on drugs. But I do think that it's important to recognize we have a lot of those programs in place here in the United States. Many of them are sponsored by Baltimore City, and they do make efforts to help addicts.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back, and we will continue our conversation with Rod Rosenstein, U.S. Attorney for the District of Maryland. We're going to take a break now, and during that break, you will hear a story about one of our great unsung civil rights heroes, Gloria Richardson. Stay with us. Rosa Parks, called the mother of the civil rights movement, was an ordinary person whose extraordinary courage in challenging segregation stimulated 5 decades of effort aimed at reaching the goal of equal protection for all. Many Marylanders also challenged segregation. In partnership with the Maryland Humanities Council this month, leading to the anniversary of Rosa Parks' decision to sit down to take a stand on December 1st, we are bringing you the stories of Marylanders who, like Rosa Parks, were ordinary citizens who courageously committed themselves to the cause.
It was totally segregated. The schools were segregated, the churches were segregated, anything recreational, pool, bowling was segregated.
That is Gloria Richardson describing the Cambridge, Maryland she grew up in. She lived there until she was 16 when she left to go to Howard University. When she returned, she married a local man, had 2 children, Donna and Tamara, and settled down for what she probably expected to be a quiet, normal life.
And then when Donna was in high school, actually, the Freedom Riders came to town.
The Freedom Riders helped Cambridge residents organize to fight for integration, holding the first civil rights demonstration in January 1962. Not long after, the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee, called CNAC, led by Gloria Richardson, helped organize demonstrations and a full-scale boycott of white businesses.
And they practically stopped the town economically over about a 3-month period because white folks were scared. I mean, you weren't bothering them, but they were scared to death to go where any picketing was, so that stopped business in the stores.
The backlash in the white community against the civil rights movement set the stage for the violent summer of 1963. Cambridge was as dangerous and backward as any Mississippi county. In late July, the National Guard camped out in Cambridge. Robert Kennedy arrived to broker a deal. This marked a turning point for Gloria Richardson. Soon after the deal was signed, CNAC began to diverge from the moderate movement that considered nonviolence the only legitimate response.
I always thought nonviolence was only a tactic because once, and I think even Gandhi said that, once you retreat into your home, you have a right not to be threatened without, you know, protecting yourself in some kind of way. I'm not really a Martin Luther King adhering. And I think that this country has pulled him up because he was less controversial and they could make him like a saint and without going further to see what lay beneath that.
Richardson continued her work in Cambridge until September 1964, when she remarried and moved to New York City, where she lives today. Though her more radical position earned her the ire of many moderates, she remained a hero of the civil rights movement. And she's an inspiration to this day, according to the current Cambridge mayor, Victoria Jackson Stanley, who's the city's first African-American mayor.
She did an excellent job. She held us together when things were not going well for us. And she forged a path that I am trying to follow. She made me who I am today.
To learn more about Gloria Richardson, visit our website at centerforemergingmedia.org. To learn more about how the Maryland Humanities Council is celebrating the legacy of Rosa Parks, please visit mdhc.org. This feature was produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Thanks to the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the C.V. Starr Center at Washington College for archival tape of Gloria Richardson. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. My guest this hour is Rod Rosenstein, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Maryland. He's been in that job since 2005. He oversees things like Project Exile and prosecuting the most vicious murders to take place in our community in cooperation with state's attorneys from across the state. He also is charged with issues around terrorism, other things we're going to talk about, and more. You can join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, as we talk with Rod Rosenstein. Or you can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Rod, we made a quip a little early. I'm just curious about this thing, though. I asked you even in the green when we were talking before we went on the air that in some senses, appointments to the U.S. Attorney's Office are political appointments. I mean, they're done by administration to administration, usually, and Republicans appoint Republicans and Democrats appoint Democrats. Not always, but for the most part, that's how it goes. And you were appointed under a Republican administration. And so the U.S. senators, usually the ones who do the nominating process and tell the president who they like to see appointed for their district and like that. And I wonder what you think is going to be your future. I mean, I ask this because when you were nominated for a judge, many people supported you, Republican and Democrat, to become a federal judge. But both the senators thought that you weren't Maryland enough and some other reasons why you weren't supported by them. And I wonder how you think your own career as the chief federal prosecutor for the state of Maryland is going to evolve after January.
Well, I really don't know the answer to that.
I figured you didn't, but I thought I'd ask you anyway.
I've spent 20 years in government, and for 16 of those years, I was an assistant U.S. attorney and a Department of Justice career prosecutor. Those are positions that are not political and that are not affected by elections, and so I've served under Republican and Democrat administrations. When I became U.S. attorney and accepted that political appointment, it's a wonderful job, but the price you pay is you lose your career status, and so you recognize that you're subject to termination at the will of the president. I could be fired at any moment, and there's no career protection. So, from my perspective, when I took the job, I realized that was a risk, and so the reality is that at some point in the future, I'm probably going to wind up in a job in the private sector, but I haven't made any plans yet. And so I don't really know where I'm going to be.
Why did you? I'm going to come back to really specific stuff about the U.S. Attorney's Office and both political and legal issues facing U.S. attorneys in America, and yourself, and go back to the prosecutions that we're talking about here in the state of Maryland. But I'm curious why you chose to become a prosecutor, why you chose to go into government work as an attorney, as a trial attorney, as opposed to most anything you could have done, which is going to be a litigator in a major corporate firm and making vast amounts more than you're making now. Tell me a bit about. I don't know that about you. I'm just curious why you chose this path.
Well, it's interesting. You know, when I joined the Department of Justice, I didn't really anticipate I'd still be there 20 years later. The reason I joined, though, was because I really didn't go to law school to make a lot of money. I went to law school because I thought I could make a difference. And I think that this job, the job of a federal prosecutor, really gives you an opportunity to make a tremendous difference. And in addition to that, you're able to use your legal skills in a way that people in the private sector aren't able to. And that is, you could prosecute cases that you truly believe in. You don't have an obligation to advocate zealously for a client if you don't believe in the client's cause. And so that, I think, is one of the most rewarding things about the job. And that's one of the things that's kept me there, is the feeling that I go in every day and get to do what I believe is the right thing. The other is, though, that you get to work with some really wonderful people. And that's one of the things I really hadn't anticipated 20 years ago, is that the colleagues that you work with in the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's Office, both the lawyers, the staff in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and also the law enforcement partners we work with in the federal agencies and the state agencies, they're just extraordinarily good people to work with. These are people who are really motivated by the public interest, who are not in it for money, but are in it to do the right thing and really working together to try to improve the community. And so for me, that's been the most rewarding aspect of the job.
Rod Rosenstein is our guest, U.S. Attorney for the state of Maryland. 410-319-8888 is the number here, 410-319-8888. Before we hit issues of terrorism and go back to issues that are facing crime in Baltimore and in the state of Maryland, 410-319-8888. There's somebody called in. Let's go to him first, and then we'll come to this. And Derwin, in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, Derwin.
Hey, I'm on the road right now listening to your program. I'm a recovering addict myself. Been clean like 12 years now.
Congratulations.
And a lot of times, the addict itself is going to commit crimes just to get drugs. So a lot of times we have to start with helping the addict first. Because if nobody's buying, then nobody can sell. You know, most programs put, somebody in a treatment center for like 30 days and then they're back on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, that's just not enough. You know, you got people that are uneducated, they can't find work, and they resort back to doing the same thing. You know, I used to have a recovery house to where I maintained to where the addict would go out and look for work, would attend meetings regularly, and there was a program set up, but now it's more about people making money than anything.
You know, I agree with you. One of the things that I've come to recognize, having been in law enforcement for 20 years, is that these persistent law enforcement challenges we face, such as drugs, are not going to be solved by police and prosecutors alone. And that's one of the reasons why I've been very pleased that we've had the opportunity to work with people who are involved in prevention and intervention. That is not just helping addicts, but helping kids, helping teenagers so they don't become addicts. You know, if we focus on the future, the next generation, we actually might be able to have an impact. And so we've worked in my office in some way to coordinate programs in schools. We have an outreach coordinator who actually works with schools to try to do anti-gang and anti-drug programming. And I agree with you. I think that's a place where we really can have an impact. Now, my office doesn't prosecute drug users just for using drugs. We prosecute drug dealers and we prosecute armed criminals. But you're absolutely right. I think if we put more effort into preventing people from becoming addicts, we can go a long way towards solving the problem.
Gentlemen, I appreciate you being part of the show, and congratulations for 12 years clean.
Okay.
Good to hear from you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Let's go to the next caller before I come up, raise another issue here at 410-319-8888. And Lisa in Silver Spring, Maryland, you're on the air.
Yes, my question is for Rod. I understand that victim witness intimidation is a big problem in Baltimore. What are you doing, or what is your office doing to combat it?
Well, we're doing a number of things. First of all, we prosecute significant cases of witness intimidation, and I think that that goes a long way. But more importantly, I think on the front end, one of the things that we do in the federal system and that our partners in the state system do as well is that we have programs to provide services to victims and witnesses. We have victim witness coordinators, people whose job it is to keep in contact with witnesses and victims and to make sure we provide them any services that they need. That may include, in appropriate cases, protection and relocation. In most cases, it's not. It's just a matter of keeping in contact with them, letting them know court dates and the status of the case. But if we establish that kind of communication, that is, if we know who the witnesses and victims are and we keep in contact with them, then we're in position to help if there ever is any intimidation. And that's the sort of program that I know that our state partners are trying to develop as well. If you have that kind of an ongoing contact, you really can provide additional reassurance to witnesses, and you can react quickly if they experience any threats.
But how do you provide protection, which seems to be unavailable, almost impossible for city and county police to do because of their lack of manpower?
Well, we provide protection in a couple of ways, you know, one of which is, depending upon the nature of the threat, if it's a low-level threat, we may just need to have the police in the neighborhood to be on alert, to drive by, maybe to stop by occasionally. But if there's a significant threat, we need to relocate a victim or witness, put them in a place where we know they're going to be safe until we eliminate the threat. In extreme cases, particularly cases in which we have cooperating gang members who agree to testify against their fellow gang members, we may even put them in a witness protection program where they're completely relocated, they get a new name, a new identity, they get to start all over again, in some cases after serving their time in federal prison. So there's a range of tools that are available to us to deal with these situations. But I think one of the keys is, as Lisa identifies, that we really do need to make sure that our law enforcement agencies are working with victims and witnesses. We can't just take their police report and walk away. We need to provide that follow-up, provide reassurances and services to them.
410-319-8888, Rod Rosenstein, the U.S. Attorney for the State of Maryland, is our guest. And Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about the outreach program that you mentioned for the area schools. I used to be a middle school teacher, and I still work in education, so it's a major priority. And I was just wondering if you could speak on how you de-glamorize gangs and drug use, because a lot of pop culture seems to make it very interesting to young adults. So could you just speak on how your program de-glamorizes the gang culture?
Well, that's exactly the challenge that we face, is how to de-glamorize it. And you know, for schools where there is a significant gang problem, it's not even a matter of de-glamorizing it. It's a matter of having to deal with the fact that kids are currently being intimidated and coerced into joining gangs. But you know, I think that let me tell you what we do. We have limited resources in my office. We really have only one person whose job it is to do this kind of outreach. But what we try to do is leverage it. So he's in contact with school resource officers, and we're developing programs in a variety of schools where we actually go into the school and do something that's tailored to the challenge a particular school faces. For example, here in Baltimore City, I've attended programs at Dunbar and Lamell Middle School, and we've gone into middle schools here because we recognize that it's, in some areas, it's too late if you go into a high school because many of your gang members have dropped out. You want to get in at a stage where you really can have an impact. And so we've developed programs, in fact, at both of those schools, we worked with an organization that puts on plays and performances to try to highlight the danger of gang membership and works with students in the school to try to help to spread a more positive message. But the key, I think, as Aaron indicates, is the teachers. We really need the teachers to be engaged in this. The teachers in our schools, first of all, they're with the kids, generally speaking, for more waking hours than the parents are. And they also know who the problem gang members are. And so what we need to do is develop programs where school resource officers working with teachers identify the problems that are unique to a school. You know, the problem's not the same in every school. It's not the same in every part of the state. But you really need to tailor the program to the challenges that your particular school faces.
Rod Rosenstein is our guest, U.S. Attorney for the state of Maryland. That means he's a federal attorney, runs all the federal cases in the state. 410-319-8888. Or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Come back to the phones in just a minute and the emails. There's a lot in the news lately, and again, this is a political question, and you're not involved in the politics of things a lot, at least not in your office officially at all. But reports have come out about intimidation when Attorney General, the Attorney General was Gonzalez, and involving Karl Rove and others in the Bush administration that pushed out and fired U.S. attorneys who refused to take cases or push things, especially around election fraud, was one of the issues they talked about. They said they didn't exist and they wouldn't push them through. This is the first part of a couple of things I want to ask you about that. Your thoughts on that. I mean, I wonder, there's always a general question about how does that affect your office and the morale in your office, because it has to affect on some levels, given all the news and people worried about what kind of pressure they're under. But two, I'd like to know your thoughts on that, if you can talk to that. I mean, when you have colleagues in New Mexico and other states that were known as great attorneys and highly ethical men doing the work that they do and are saying that they were pushed out for political reasons by the administration that appointed you, what do you say to that?
Well, men and women, actually.
I meant to say men and women when I said it.
I did know a few of them, and a couple of them I knew fairly well, and they were exceptional prosecutors. Fortunately, it didn't affect us here in Maryland. I think one of the reasons for that was that the firings were going on around the time that I was hired. And they were looking at U.S. attorneys who already had served out their four-year terms. And under the law, if you serve your four-year term, you can carry on indefinitely until you're replaced. But technically, your term is 4 years. And those are the folks, my understanding is, those are the folks that they were looking at replacing. So it didn't affect me here. But obviously, it does affect us in the sense that a lot of what we do depends upon public confidence in law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And it's particularly important to me that people know that they can have faith in the integrity of the U.S. Attorney's Office and the integrity of the Department of Justice. And so the impact that this whole episode has had on me and my colleagues, apart from the personal impact on the people who were affected, it's really a question of what you do to maintain that public trust. And I believe that fundamentally we continue to have and continue to deserve that public trust. The Department of Justice is a huge institution with thousands of lawyers and many supervisors. And the reality is that 99% of the work of the U.S. Attorney's offices in the Department of Justice was unaffected even by all those allegations. And so I hope that as time goes by, those issues will fade and people will be able to have that confidence in the Department of Justice, because we really do rely on that. When we stand up in front of a jury and ask somebody to find a defendant guilty and we're standing up on behalf of the United States, we want the jurors to know that we're doing that in good faith and not based on any improper political considerations.
Now, because I know in the report that was released, some of the things I've been reading about it over the last few days is that the report found, and I'll just quote, it found significant evidence that political partisan considerations were an important factor in the removal of several U.S. attorneys, including David Iglesias, U.S. attorney for New Mexico, influential Republicans kind of helping push him out the door, that found that Mr. Gonzalez's chief of staff and his deputy, quote, failed to provide accurate and truthful statements about the removals and their role in the process. I mean, these are your colleagues. These are people who are in your system. I mean, that kind of undue political pressure, to me, while not a murder in the streets, is almost as abhorrent when it comes to its effect on our system.
To the extent that political considerations went into the process in terms of the impact on the cases, I agree with you. One of the odd things about the position of U.S. attorney is that it's sort of a mixture of law and politics. That is, that the process of selecting a U.S. attorney, you'd like to think it's based somewhat on merit, but it's not obviously completely on merit. The president and the attorney general have whatever agenda they want to be pursued. For example, it might be in one administration an emphasis on violent crime, on corporate fraud, on child exploitation and abuse, some of these issues that we've pursued. And to the extent that you're getting pushed from Washington to pursue those priorities, that may be, in a sense, political, but it's not improper political interference because it's a priority. It's pushing a priority area, not pushing a particular case. To the extent that anybody in Washington is trying to make a decision based upon the impact on a case, that is because they want somebody of a particular party prosecuted or a particular individual case impacted. That would be wrong. And to me, that really strikes at the heart of the integrity of the Department of Justice.
In some sense, that's what they're saying is happening here.
Well, that's what I think some people are saying happened in some cases.
Right.
As I say, I think that you would hope that that didn't impact any particular prosecutions. And I think that's one of the issues that sort of remains open, that is, did this decision-making process in Washington, to the extent it may have been improperly motivated, did it actually impact any cases? And I don't know that anybody's made any conclusive determination about that.
No, they haven't. I mean, but the idea that people were influencing certain, trying to push U.S. attorneys to prosecute certain cases that would benefit a party politically, which was some of the accusations here. I mean, even the man you replaced, DiBiaggio, I mean, part of that was political. People were saying that he maintained, other people maintained, that with the collusion of people, whether it's true or not, nobody knows, of the people within Governor Ehrlich's administration, to want him out of the way because he was going to look into allegations and had a grand jury about the power of slots, money, and gambling in the political process here in Maryland. And I mean, so that kind of politics seems to kind of worm its way into things. So that's a pretty scary thing. And I mean, when you took over, you didn't continue to prosecute that case. Well, whatever happened to that case?
The case you had in mind actually was dismissed before I became U.S.
attorney. It was dismissed before you became U.S. attorney.
That's right. But as I say, when you take this job, you recognize you have a responsibility not to allow those improper political considerations to influence your cases. And if it came to that, you need to be prepared to leave the job. And so I think the fact that somebody lost their job as U.S. attorney to me is less serious than if they had actually allowed that pressure to influence their handling of a particular case. And to me, that's where the integrity of the Department of Justice is most at issue, and our ability to know that each individual case is prosecuted on its merits and not because some politician wants it prosecuted. And I can tell you that the cases that we have here in Maryland, there's been no influence at all in how we handle particular cases from any politicians.
Rod Rosenstein is our guest, U.S. Attorney for the District of Maryland. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Let me go back to some law issues here. There are other cases besides murder cases that you prosecute.
That's correct. And in fact, we prosecute statewide somewhere in the neighborhood of 800 defendants a year. And we've talked about the number of exile-related cases, about 200 here in Baltimore City. But our responsibility extends statewide and extends to an entire array of federal crimes, everything from violent crime to white-collar fraud and corruption. One of our priorities, which I mentioned briefly earlier, has been child exploitation, and that's an area that has become an increasing focus of federal law enforcement over the past couple of years, in particular because we've experienced with the explosion of the internet, an explosion in child exploitation online. That is, people trading in images of child pornography, people using the internet to try to identify children as victims of pedophiles. And so we've made it a federal priority to try to help our state colleagues in dealing with those cases. And as a result, we've had an increasing number of federal prosecutions under our Project Safe Childhood program, which are generally going to involve trading in images of child pornography or transporting children across state lines for the purpose of sexual activity.
How many of those cases do you prosecute?
We've prosecuted, I believe we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 30 in federal court over the past year, which is a significant increase over what we did previously. And this is an area where, just as with the exile cases, the majority of cases of sexual abuse are going to be handled by state prosecutors. What we're doing is we're lending our federal resources to cases where we think they're going to have the most impact. And often those are cases, as I said, involving photographs of children. And one of the advantages that we have in federal court is that if somebody is caught with photographs of child pornography, they're subject to federal prosecution and substantial federal sentences without having to call the child as a witness. And sometimes we've had situations where...
Even if it's within a state? If somebody in Montgomery County has these photographs and they're arrested, that can be a federal case?
It can be a federal case if the images have crossed state lines or if the images are maintained on any media that have crossed state lines. So if you're talking about a computer that was manufactured out of state or a disk, for example. So practically speaking, any kind of electronic media that are used to store child pornography can be subject to federal prosecution. And so as you can imagine, we're not prosecuting everybody who has child pornography in federal court. We're trying to be selective about it and work with our state partners. And one of the most significant areas where we focused is cases where we have either evidence or reason to believe that somebody has been engaged in personally sexually abusing a child, but that if we were to pursue that case in state court, the child would be victimized again by having to testify about this abuse. And so by bringing those sort of cases in federal court, we're able to hold the defendant accountable without exposing the victim to a trial. In addition, we've been involved in cases involving child rescues, which are the most satisfying from my perspective. We had one, for example, where a law enforcement officer in Canada observed in a new photo of child pornography. And when I say new, law enforcement keeps track of all known images of child pornography. So if there's a new victim, they know to be on alert. And in this particular case, to make a long story short, they were able to trace the victim here to Maryland and arrest the perpetrators. That's a case where we were actually involved in rescuing a child who would have been subject to subsequent abuse. And those are the cases, from our perspective, that are really most satisfying.
And so we don't have much time here left. We never got a chance to get into the issues of trafficking in women, which is something that more and more the U.S. attorneys has become one of the highest growth areas in crime, nationally and internationally, has been the international and national transportation of women for the use in prostitution.
For us, that falls in the category of human trafficking, and we typically don't prosecute prostitution cases in federal court, but we do prosecute cases where victims have been trafficked from out of the country. Often they are held under adverse conditions. Their passports may be held. They may be illegal aliens who are not free to go to law enforcement. Those people have been a priority for us.
We are out of time. I wish we had more time. There's so much more I wanted to ask you. Other people are calling in. I apologize. Maybe before this is out, we can have Rod Rosenstein back with us, U.S. Attorney for the State of Maryland. Thank you so much for taking your time. It's been a pleasure to see you again and have you in the studio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. Our interns are Stavros Halkias, Charles Harris, and Judith Lloyd. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. We're engineered this hour by Melvin Jones. And to podcast this and all of our other shows and new programming, please visit us on the web at www.steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.